I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. 18 years ago, the state of Maryland deregulated its electricity market. Has deregulation delivered on the promise of lower prices and greener alternatives? About 500,000 Marylanders buy their electricity from retail suppliers. Are these companies offering better deals? Are they as reliable as legacy electric companies? In the next 3 years, the state wants us to get 25% of our energy from renewable sources. Has the retail market helped in that regard? Kent Mottis is the Energy Policy Manager at the Maryland Energy Administration. Tim Brennan is a professor at UMBC and a senior fellow at Resources for the Future. Ryan Handy covers energy issues for the Houston Chronicle. They join me to talk about options for purchasing power. Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall on this beautiful day in our neighborhood, at least here in Charles Village, the international headquarters of WIPR Radio. I hope it's as nice where you are as it is where we are. Today, we're going to talk about energy and energy markets. Maryland deregulated its energy markets in 1999 to create a free market of decentralized energy suppliers who would offer a variety of services and competitive prices. More than 100 companies have jumped into the fray. So today we're going to have a conversation about how it's working. It's likely that you've received letters or phone calls encouraging you to abandon your traditional supplier and transition to a retail energy company. For most Marylanders, that traditional supplier is BGE or Pepco, which BGE now owns. The independent companies promise price stability, asserting that standard offer services like BGE are subject to the whims of energy markets. So far, roughly a fifth of Marylanders have chosen to make the switch to an independent company. So deregulation is also intended in part to make companies and consumers greener in their energy consumption. Most retail companies include alternative energy sources such as solar and wind power, as well as more traditional sources like coal. So in this hour, we'll talk pros and cons of deregulation for consumers and for the environment. Is retail energy cheaper? Is it reliable? Is it a good way for people to support the development of alternative energy in their communities? Ken Mottis is with me here in Studio A. He's an energy policy manager at the Maryland Energy Administration. Kent, it's nice to meet you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
You are, yes.
Okay, good. For once, I lucked out. Tim Brennan joins us on the phone from Silver Spring. He's a professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, where he teaches economics and public policy. He's also a senior fellow at Resources for the Future. They do economic research on environmental policy. Tim Brennan, welcome to Midday.
Hi, Tom. Thanks very much. I'm actually in D.C. at the RFF offices right now.
Okay. Well, we're happy to have you from D.C. And Ryan May Handy joins us on the phone from Houston, Texas. She covers energy issues for the Houston Chronicle. Ms. Handy, welcome to you as well.
Great to be here.
You are welcome to join our conversation about energy markets. Are you one of the 500,000 roughly Marylanders who currently get their energy from someone other than BGE or Pepco? Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Kent Mottis, let me ask you just generally, how does this work? What's the deal?
Yeah, so in essence, when the legislation was passed, it transitioned the state from having monopoly utilities that were the sole providers of electricity to opening it up to some competition. And so really what that means is you, as a Maryland resident, are automatically a customer of the utility. You are on what they call standard offer service. And in order, if you want to switch away from that, there are a variety of different suppliers depending on what area you're in. There can be anywhere from about 30 to more than 60 different suppliers in that area who can offer you services. And what you would do is you would look at their website, or they would talk to you and see what your preferences are, what is important to you, and they can probably offer you a plan that meets those needs in a different way than the vanilla sort of standard service that you would get from the utility.
And does the standard service, BGE or Pepco, depending on where you live here in Maryland, are they still involved in this process at all?
Yeah, so kind of. They are still the ones that are going to deliver the electricity to you. They still own the poles and the wires. through which the electricity comes, but you're actually purchasing the electricity from the supplier who either, you know, owns a power plant, or they're contracting with a power plant, or they're purchasing that electricity through a wholesale market.
And Tim Brennan, is it true that even though we've got these so-called SOS companies like BGE, Pepco, et cetera, that they are not able to offer the range of services or the range of alternatives that these independent companies can offer?
That's possible. You know, the independent companies, as Kent sort of noted, they may be able to offer, or as you noted in your introduction, they may be able to offer, you know, different kinds of payment options, you know, guard against volatility either through some sort of long-term contract arrangement. They may make claims about offering greener power. Perhaps they procure it from, you know, as you know, from some power supplier up the chain. So it's certainly possible that they can.
And Ryan Mahandy, you cover this area of energy and regulation, that kind of thing, in Houston. Deregulation happened in Texas in 2002. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And since then, I mean, has it been considered a success? I mean, how do you think people feel about how it's working in Texas?
That's a great question. I think it depends on who you ask. I mean, the original intention of deregulating in Texas was to lower electricity prices. So most of Texas is deregulated, which means most people buy their power now through a retail electric provider. But there are still pockets where people go through the traditional regulated utility. And there have been a couple studies that were done this year, actually, that were kind of looking at, has this experiment worked? Has it lowered our electricity prices? And what they have found is that if you live in an area that's been deregulated, your electricity prices have, on average, gone down, but they're still higher than those prices in areas that are still regulated. So on the one hand, yes, the experiment has worked. Electricity prices for most of Texas are being lowered. But on the other hand, they're still not as low as they could be in other areas. And there are plenty of people in Texas who love shopping for their power. They know how to work the system. They know how to get the cheapest power possible. But a lot of people find the system really confusing, deliberately so even, and would like it to go back to the way it was before.
Kent Motais, let me ask you what is probably a really dumb question, but on the other hand, I'm a really dumb guy, so it's not surprising that I would ask it. Why is it, you know, I get things, my electricity in our house is still from BGE, and I get things, I've gotten a couple in the last couple of weeks when we've had these really hot days. We get these energy saving days, you know, where you get extra credit for using less energy on the really hot days. Why is it in the best interest of the gas and electric company to have consumers use less of their product? Don't they make less money if that happens?
Not anymore. So Maryland has also decoupled their electricity. And so what that means basically is that the utilities are not necessarily – they don't get the revenue based on the amount that they're selling. And so really usually what that means when they're offering something like that is there's a wholesale market which is organized by PJM, which is the regional transmission operator, and they offer a market where if a utility can decrease – their total usage on a particularly hot day, then the utility can make money based on that. And so when they're offering
that, so they actually make money if less electricity is used.
Right, because when more electricity is used on a particularly hot day, it causes stress on the transmission system, which increases prices. And so if they can relieve that stress by calling on BGE, saying, hey, on this day, please, you know, if you could decrease your electricity, that will, you know, provide benefits to the overall system. And so they're able to pass down some of that to their customers.
Of course, this is separate and distinct from the sort of moral, ethical obligation we all should have to use less energy. I mean, that's a whole different issue. And Tim Brennan, these companies, these independent companies, and my count is there's about 111 of them active here offering electricity in Maryland. But those companies don't all come from Maryland, right? I mean, this is a national market, is it not?
That may well be. I'll confess, I don't really know that much about these 111 companies because I haven't really studied them that thing lately. I just want to elaborate on something Ken said, and sort of with your question, is that to get electricity generated in those hours that where Pepco or BGE is calling you to use less can cost, you know, $3-4 a kilowatt hour. And if your normal rate is 12 cents a kilowatt hour, you're imposing enormous costs on the suppliers, whether it's, you know, on BGE or whether it's these other companies for that matter. And so they certainly want you to use less. One way to get people to do that would be to actually charge them the price that the electricity costs at that time. Another way to do that, which Kent sort of explained with because of the money that they get through PJM through a complicated process that we'd spend the rest of the day trying to describe, that the way it works in Maryland is that you actually will get paid to use less. So you actually still, sort of, if you're getting paid $1.50 to use a kilowatt hour or less electricity, that means if you want to use more, essentially you're paying $1.50 a kilowatt hour. And so that way they get that worked in. So I just want to be clear to everybody that that while there is an issue about utilities losing money with energy efficiency and other sorts of things that reduce electricity demand overall, what happens at these critical peak periods, these hot August afternoons, is a whole separate question.
And Ryan Mahandy in Houston, it's interesting that the regulated markets appear to have cheaper electricity than the unregulated markets in Texas. That really is kind of shocking in a way. I mean, that's the whole point of this, is to make things more economically beneficial. Is there any particular reason that people are pointing to this? I mean, what's the explanation?
That's a good question. I don't fully understand it myself, but the part of it is that when you are in a deregulated part of the electricity grid, you have to buy your power through a retail electric provider. So you essentially have an extra bill, an extra piece in the equation. So you're paying for your wires to actually get your power. So you're paying a transmission company and you're paying a retail electric provider. And the retail electric providers, they kind of pad their fees, so to speak. So they've got to run a business on their own. They sometimes have marketing fees. So a piece of this could be is that you are paying for things with your retail electric provider that you wouldn't normally be paying for if you were just plugged in to, like, say, the municipal-run utility. And so there's just more involved there. And another interesting point about this, any sort of decrease that we have seen in deregulated prices in Texas could be attributable to low natural gas prices, which, as of last year, hit a near 20-year low. And that's really shaking up the utility industry as a whole. And it has really helped drop prices here in Texas in the deregulated zone. But without the low natural gas prices, would we have seen that drop? Probably not.
Yeah. So if the natural gas prices go up, I mean, if you're in the oil business, you know that it's a very volatile business. I mean, it goes up, it goes down, and maybe the natural gas business will end up being the same thing. We could see higher rates in Texas and everywhere else. Is that right, Ryan Handy?
Yeah, that's definitely possible. And another thing that's happening in Texas is that the transmission companies are still regulated by the state. And so they're guaranteed a rate of return. They have to make a certain amount of money and they can raise their rates. And they have raised their rates every year. So you've got, if electricity prices go up again, it could be because natural gas prices will swing up the other way. And then you also are paying more for transmission. And suddenly maybe the benefits of retail electric providers in a deregulated market will disappear or look mm-hmm. less attractive.
And Kent Motais, what has the effect on BGE been? You know, the standard legacy company. Are their margins getting squeezed? Are they having to do business in a very different model? I mean, ironically, the company that used to own BGE, Constellation Energy, spun BGE off several years ago so that they, Constellation, could enter the independent retail market. So they are now one of these companies supplying independently, electricity to Marylanders and I guess to people other places. But what has that done? Has it in fact, resulted in BGE or BGE having a different business model?
It's hard to say. I mean, nationally, the utilities are in a transition sort of state where people are trying to figure that out. I think it's hard to say exactly without looking at BGE's books, but in general, the point that Ryan made about the rate of return is true. So there are two parts on your bill. There's the supply side and then the distribution side. And on the distribution side, that is where the utilities making all of their revenue to cover all of the investments that they're making in the distribution system, the transmission stations, the poles, the wires, that kind of thing. And so that's separate because that's still regulated by the Public Service Commission, which is the regulatory body that oversees the utilities. And the supply side is, because it's the unregulated side, for BGE, when they go and set the prices with the commission, they are able to get all of their revenue back. And that's part of the deal that they've struck with the state. And so that they're still in some cases, because it's, I mean, the deregulation has been a process and it's certainly not complete, but there are still some areas where they're able to go into other areas and certainly make some revenue.
And Tim Brennan, before we take a break, when we hear the term unregulated markets, it you know, engenders thoughts of the wild, wild west and all sorts of crazy things going on. I mean, are these independent companies overseen in any way by a public government entity?
Sure. I think that there may be financial viability tests they have to have in order to get permission to operate in Maryland. Kent would know the details on that. But they're certainly subject to, you know, FTC, consumer protection laws, and things along those lines. And, you know, so you certainly have that, those sorts of things in the sector as well. And then there are other sorts of regulatory issues that come up that affect those retail providers and also the competition, which is in some sense separate, the competition at the wholesale end, which is the people who generate the power competing to make it available to either BGE under standard offer service or these other 111 companies to supply the electricity that gets delivered to us.
Ryan Mahandy covers energy for the Houston Chronicle. Tim Brennan, we just heard from him. He's a professor of economics and public policy at UMBC and a senior fellow at Resources for the Future. Kent Motais is an energy policy manager at the Maryland Energy Administration. We're talking options for power here in Maryland. And as always, you are welcome to join the conversation, one might say. We are happy to empower you to do that. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You want to follow us on Twitter? That's a great idea. @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us. And welcome back, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us today on Midday. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, it's another installment of Smart Nutrition with the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagel. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review a show called Fallout at the Vagabond Players here in Baltimore. If you're just tuning in today, we're talking about energy deregulation in Maryland and beyond. Tim Brennan is a professor of economics and public policy at UMBC, and he's a senior fellow at Resources for the Future. Kent Motais is an energy policy manager at the Maryland Energy Administration, and Ryan Mahandy reports on energy for the Houston Chronicle. You are welcome to join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wypr.org. And we'd love to have you follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @MiddayTomHall. Ryan Mahandy, in Texas, how many people are involved in the retail energy market? How many people are getting their energy from those sources rather than the sort of legacy companies?
Well, it's really most of the state, I think maybe about 90%. So millions and millions of people. Most Texans shop for their power, as we like to say. And a lot of people really like it. They can pick their own plan, they can pick their own energy provider, and they can change their plan if they want to get cheaper energy.
And Kent Motais, here in Maryland, as I understand, it's about 500,000 people. It's about 20% or so, 21%. At one point, it seemed to be about 30%. There seemed to be more people doing it. Why are there fewer people now than a few years ago?
Yeah, so there's some fewer now. It looks like it sort of hit the peak prior to the polar vortex in 2014 when it was close. I think it was 26, 27%, something like that. And then currently, it's down to just over 20%, which equates to about 450,000 residential customers and about 100,000 businesses.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, is it expected? Is this a normal ebb and flow? I mean, would one expect that this number of people taking advantage of the retail markets to go up and down and up and down, or is it considered something that's likely to be on an upward trajectory?
I think as we continue to make progress in the deregulation and fixing some of the things that maybe we didn't see, we expect that to increase. I think there are a few things that we're working at the Maryland Energy Administration with the hopes of doing that. You know, we hope to see more Marylanders in the future at least shopping, educating themselves so that they can see whether or not there are better options out there for them. Or, you know, one of the things that we're looking at is the portability issue. So right now in Maryland, if you shop with a supplier and you move to a house across the street, you can't take that service with you the way that you might with your cable or your internet. Instead, you have to go back on the standard offer service and then switch again after a certain period of time. And so things like that, which are, you know, probably not a huge deal, do impact that overall number of people switching.
Mm-hmm. And Tim Brennan, you're an economics professor and you study public policy, and your work at this think tank in D.C. called Resources for the Future. You talk about the general economic impact of or you study the general economic impact of this kind of thing. I mean, in an overarching way, what can you tell us about the impact in these last however many years has been, 18 years, I guess, of deregulation here in Maryland?
Like a lot of things, it's kind of mixed in terms of that, as other people have said, some people win, some people lose. One of the virtues of having markets is that it better ties prices to cost. And sometimes when costs are high, prices go up. Sometimes when they're not, they go down. And if you happen to be someone who, for example, uses a lot of power on peak or something like that, you might see a difference or a pattern than others. But I think an important thing to keep in mind here is that we've been talking a lot about household adoption, but in Maryland and I think around the country, very roughly, about a third of electricity is consumed by households, about a third by small businesses, and about a third by industrial users. And so, at least certainly in the early days in Maryland, when hardly anybody, any residential user, was switching to a new entrant, a lot of the commercial and industrial users had done so. And there's a sense in which, you know, if that 65% of the market was working pretty well because people were, you know, doing the looking and making choices and had the wherewithal to figure out the right way to purchase electricity for themselves, you could get a lot of benefits right there, even if one had never deregulated sales to residents at all.
And Ryan Mahandy, when it comes to the folks in Texas shopping for their electricity, and it sounds like this is quite an amateur sport in Texas that people enjoy participating in, you know, for the coupon clippers among us, I mean, there's nothing that makes my heart go pitter-patter more than, you know, buy one, get one free hummus. What are they shopping for? What are they looking for? And what are they forcing companies to be competitive about specifically? I mean, is it alternative energy? Is it simply a matter of price per kilowatt? What are they demanding?
So I think alternative energy, so green energy, wind power, solar power, is becoming a huge thing here in Texas. Wind power is really big here. Solar power, not so much. But there is a lot of push from people who want to see a green energy label on their retail electric provider. But they also are really into getting cheap power. And it is, you're right, it is a completely competitive sport. I know several people that compare their electric plans, and they're always competing for who got the cheapest power. So we've got a state-run website called powertochoose.org. And here you can find all the electricity plans in the state. So you can put in your average electricity use, which you can get from your bill, and it will show you, you know, hundreds of plans based upon the average cost per kilowatt hour of usage. And it can be 7 cents, they can be 10 cents per kilowatt hour. So that's one way to shop. The other way you can look for power is where your power mix is coming from. So if you want green energy, we have several retail electricity plans here that purport to offer 100% green energy or 10% green energy. And the catch here is that you're not actually getting electrons from a solar utility-scale solar system or from a wind turbine farm. You're getting the same electrons as your neighbor, which could be coming from, you know, a coal-fired power plant. But the point is that you can subsidize another company's investment in renewable energy. So there is a benefit. It's just not quite as clear-cut as it might seem when you look up the plan on the internet.
That's interesting. So what would it take to have direct access to those electrons produced by a solar source or a wind source? I mean, is it just logistically in terms of the transferal of that power difficult to get from, you know, the plant to the house? How does that work?
I mean, my understanding is that, I mean, the transmission system is the transmission system. And if you want electrons that you know definitely were produced by solar power, then you've got to get a rooftop solar set up and put it on your house. And as far as I'm aware, there's really no way to directly connect into the grid into a wind farm unless, you know, you are connected into a wind farm. Mm-hmm. So we have this pre-existing transmission system that is just shuttling electricity to us the way it pretty much always has been. And if you really want to go green, then you've got to get solar panels on your roof. And interestingly, here in Texas, we don't have a lot of incentives or really any incentives, you know, like tax benefits to, you know, encourage people to put solar panels on the roof. But there are a lot of retail electric providers that are now offering special energy plans, and they'll work with you. They'll partner with the solar company and you can get solar panels put on your roof. And this retail electric company will pay you back maybe for the extra energy that you are generating. So in that way, having a retail electric company here in Texas working with someone who wants to get solar panels is a really good partnership.
And Kent Motais, some of the companies here in Maryland are offering things like fixed rates, at least for a particular period of time. And they're offering, as Ryan is saying, ways of accessing or at least supporting solar and wind. I mean, are there incentives? Are there tax incentives? Are there things that the state feels compelled to do to encourage people to use alternative energy sources here?
Yeah, so I think it's important to note that, you know, a lot of it is some part of it is the customer choice and the people wanting renewable sources, but there's sort of a combination of different policies in place here where the Renewable Portfolio Standard plays a role in Maryland, which requires suppliers to either purchase a certain amount of their electricity from renewable sources or to buy the credits that go along with that in order to meet the state goals. And so there are also the grants and other incentives that sort of the Maryland Energy Administration gives out, but also there's the net metering law, which helps to subsidize on roof housing, that sort of thing.
I want to talk a little bit about the cost here. There's an email from Stephen who writes, in 2015, I switched from BGE to a company called Palmco due to an attractive offer. A few months later, without my knowledge or permission, Palmco switched me to a, quote, budget billing program that resulted in years of overcharging. We have on the line with us Laurel Peltier. She is a writer for the Baltimore Fishbowl who has written about this very thing. And Laurel, you talked to some of your friends and people that you know and compared energy bills the way Ryan was talking about. They're doing that in Texas. What did you find in your reporting?
Hi, gang. Thanks a lot for the opportunity. The reason I got into really looking at what people were paying is because I'm a huge fan of switching your home to clean energy. I mean, you know, 85% of the rooftops in Baltimore can't take solar, but I can choose a green provider. But I'm kind of a coupon clipper, and I really understand pricing. I know that BGE's kilowatt rate has been around 9 cents for the past 3 to 4 years. So when I go online, you know, I just kind of know the pricing. But what I noticed is friends would come to me, and they would say, hey, can you check out my bill? And I'd look at it, and I mean, I would see rates of 13 cents, 12 cents. They'd switch suppliers. And it really kind of got me looking into the issue, which then hooked me up with this great reporter up in Maine, because these pricing issues have been kind of cropping up in all the states up and down the East Coast. And he said, hey, you can see what people are actually paying in Maryland on a per kilowatt basis. The federal government puts out these really cool reports, so I ran some numbers after looking at a lot of BGE bills that were on what are called variable rates. And I thought, what is going on here? Why are so many people on variable rates? And it turns out that in Maryland, we have been paying, when you actually run the numbers and you see people have switched, we're paying on average, at least 12% more. And many people are paying much higher rates because they've inadvertently signed on to like a really great teaser rate that beats BG&E, but they didn't notice that the account was then switched to variable rates, which fluctuate up and down. And what I think is really interesting about this market is it is a consumer market that has very little advertising with it. And most people have really want to choose lower rates or choose a great renewable product, but they make a decision and don't realize that they've actually chosen a product with higher rates. And it's not until I show them and explain to them that a variable rate changes month to month and actually BG&E's rates are fixed to rates a year. So what I'm finding is just what the previous caller had said, is that a relatively uninformed consumer base is switching to suppliers and later finding out that they're not getting what they thought they were getting.
And Tim Brenner, when it comes to regulation, I mean, obviously the Public Service Commission regulates the rates that BGE is allowed to charge. So as Laurel is mentioning, they tend to be less volatile than other rates. But so it cell phone companies do this kind of thing a lot of the time. You know, sign up for the first 2 months and or 3 months, and it's such and such a rate, and then when you forget all about it, the rates go up and become variable. Is this an area that regulators should be taking a look at? I mean, is this something that the government should get involved in trying to corral in?
Sure. I mean, there's the Federal Trade Commission, for example, and I don't know how much at the state can't be able to talk about that. That people can't lie when they're offering you things and do things to you and that sort of stuff, and so one's got to be, look at these things, look to see whether the contracts are on the up and up, and so on. Stories like this may be why the numbers of people who have just gone back to BG&E have gone up that you were talking about before, and I confess that as much as a consumer as anything else, that whenever I get those envelopes in the mail, I just toss them in the trash. I figure, whenever someone says we guarantee a certain rate for a certain amount of time, that's telling me, and after that time is up, you'd better hang on. So I think caution is understandable, especially because although, people here and a lot of people who listen to these conversations, think the idea of customer engagement with power and sitting around and trying to compare rates and all that kind of stuff is a lot of fun. I personally don't know a lot of people, maybe it's different in Texas, who really enjoy that sort of thing. I've seen people talking about getting various kinds of certifications for power suppliers, showing these people with these big smiles on their faces looking at spreadsheets on their laptops. I'm thinking, do people really want to do that? But maybe there's enough people who do.
Well, ain't no way of describing one person's good time versus another one's. I mean, Ryan Handy, before we take a break, Ryan, I mean, in Texas, what's your take on the level of consumer awareness, the level of consumer erudition? I mean, Laurel Peltier talked about the fact that just, so many of us just don't know. This is a very complicated thing. I mean, Kent has talked about the difference between the transmission as opposed to the, creation of the source itself. I mean, this is confusing, and the pricing plans are confusing. Do you think there's a fair amount of hipness to this topic in the state of Texas?
Now that you mention it, most of the people who write me about their power bills and really understand them far better than I do are engineers, and they know how to build a big spreadsheet and track their power. And I really think that majority of people are just average. They're used to getting their power, they're used to paying their bill, they're used to not having to think about it. And a lot of the smarts you need to navigate this retail electric deregulated world, a lot of people just don't have them or not interested in them, and they don't want to waste their time thinking about it. And they just want to, stick with the company they've always known and just leave it at that. And as a result, I think we've had this same problem in Texas where people get into what we call gimmicky rates. you go for something that sounds good, but you don't read the fine print, or if you do read the fine print, it doesn't make any sense to you, and you end up, you know, paying a higher rate eventually, or paying a higher rate when you go above a certain power usage level. So, you know, for the majority of people, myself included, it just sometimes seems easier to just go with what you know. And that can be really dangerous.
Before we take a break, and Laurel Peltier, before we let you go, talk about the issue of what folks in the business call slamming, and this thing. There's a thing on our in each of our electric bills that says it's an electric choice ID number, and there are those who suggest that you shouldn't reveal what that number is until you're absolutely sure you want to make a switch. How does that all work?
I think, Tom, you asked me the question. When I think most people have had someone come to their door and try and sell them energy, generally electricity, and then people tend to sign on to gas during the process. And your electric choice ID number and the gas ID number, if you flip over your BG&E bill, they're up at the top. And they're a second number. I kind of call it the social security number of your account. And I would treat it that way, especially if you have someone at your door who's trying to sell you energy and you're, you know how you get a little, almost a little stressed out a bit, but you believe them, is don't show that to people, because people who aren't on the up and up, and I will say that if you've noticed this year that it's gotten better on the purchasing side of electric supply, it's because the PSE did put Public Service Commission did a two-year project, and they did put a lot of regulations in place for the purchasing of green electricity. I'm sorry, electricity retail. So you'll notice that people at the door now have badges. They're more vetted. It has gotten better on the purchasing side of things.
Yeah, but it's still a buyer beware situation, isn't
Well, and
it? Yeah.
This is really what I want to share. It is a deregulated pricing. Nobody regulates pricing, and I can share with you, I've seen rates that are 40, 50, 60% over the BG&E standard.
Yeah, so you got to read the fine print quickly. All right, we got to take a break. Laurel Peltier, thank you so much for joining us. Laurel Peltier writes about energy and environmental issues for the Baltimore Fishbowl. Ryan Mahandy joins us on the phone from Texas. She covers energy for the Houston Chronicle. Kent Motice is an energy policy manager at the Maryland Energy Administration. And Tim Brennan, he teaches economics and public policy at UMBC, and he's a senior fellow at Resources for the Future. We'll have more on energy deregulation when we return from a quick break. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just tuning in today, we're discussing options for purchasing electricity. There are more than 100 companies offering an alternative to the so-called SOS companies like BGE or Pepco. SOS means Standard Offer Services. So do you buy the juice for your home or your business from these legacy companies, or are you one of the 500,000 people or so here in Maryland who have made the switch to an independent company? We're talking about this with Kent Motice of the Maryland Energy Administration, Ryan Mahandy, an energy reporter for the Houston Chronicle, and Tim Brennan, a professor at UMBC, and he's also with the environmental think tank Resources for the Future. We'd love to hear your story as well. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. We have a email here from Michael, who says one option which needs to be discussed is residential solar power. Residential solar makes the grid more robust since it produces the most during sunny, hot peak demand days. And by decentralizing production of electricity, the grid becomes more reliable and power companies need to spend less maintaining it. Kent Motice, let's talk about this issue that Michael brings up when it comes to reliability. Is there any, have there been problems with people getting their electricity if they, are customers of one of these independent companies?
So the short answer is not really, in part because you know, even if you get your electricity from one of these retail suppliers, if for whatever reason you were dropped by them, you would still have that standard offer service that you would still receive your electricity from. And so it acts as sort of a backstop, you know, should anything happen, but it's not, you know, depending on what sort of electricity supplier you go with, the probability of that is more or maybe less.
Mm-hmm. And Tim Brennan, about 6 years ago, Senator Jim Rosapep wrote an op-ed piece in the Baltimore Sun arguing against deregulation. He thought it was a bad idea. And again, it had happened in Maryland back in 1999. So, you know, 12 years hence, Senator Rosapep was writing about it. He said that the two things that bothered him the most, that number one, it encouraged a culture of financial speculation in utility boardrooms. I mean, are utility companies acting differently because of this deregulated market, and are they acting in ways that are risky? I mean, are there analogies to the risks that they are taking with the risks that the banking industry and the financial industry took back in 2007 and 2008?
I don't think so. Based on what people have said so far, probably the fly-by-nighters or these other 111 companies, perhaps more than the major utilities. I do think that they do face reliability problems, and the question that came in on the email is a good one on that, because solar actually presents a couple of challenges for utilities. One is that if you happen to have the sun at hot times, that's great. On the other hand, if a cloud blows over, all of a sudden that power drops right off, and trying to maintain a system when you've got intermittent power is a challenge for the engineers. And the other thing is that the utilities are facing, this goes back to the business model issue a little bit, is that they're facing this and they're being challenged by regulators across the country into how do they transform themselves from being one-way streets to two-way streets, which is, you know, the traditional power this distribution system, as people have described, is you have like big generators like out there in the country someplace, and through big transmission lines they deliver power to local distribution companies like BGE or Pepco, and then those get delivered, and then that power gets delivered to us. If we start generating our own power, a lot of what can happen is that the solar panels can generate more power than we happen to be using at a particular time, and people want to be able to sell that back into the general electricity market, which is great. But then all of a sudden these utilities, which were running one way operations, are now being asked to run two way operations with intermittent supplies, and my sense of the engineering is that that's not a no brainer.
Tim Brennan teaches economics and public policy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He joins us on the phone from Washington. Ryan Handy covers energy for the Houston Chronicle. She's on the line from Texas. And Kent Motais is an energy policy manager at the Maryland Energy Administration. He's here with me in Studio A. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. We're talking about energy deregulation and options for electricity. Let's go to the phones. Dick in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Oh, thanks for having me on. You know, on the solar panel thing, I think a bigger problem for the utilities is that the people who are generating electricity are paying a rate based on the amount that they use from the utility. And, of course, we have solar panels. We pay $8 a month during the 6 months of the year, and that's only an $8 customer charge. So we're not contributing money for things like upkeep of the grid, except for that $8. The taxes and the fees that are charged based on your usage, ours are down to zero.
Mm-hmm. So what did it cost for you to have those solar panels put in place in your home?
Well, we did it in 2013, so we got a 30% federal tax credit and a $1,000 grant from the state government. And it was under $10,000.
Mm-hmm. And then, so for the last 4 years, then you've been paying along the lines of $8 a month for electricity. So, how long have you done the the amortization table on this? How long is it going to take you to get your $10,000 back?
We'll have it paid off in about 2 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting money back from BGE once a year. Not a lot, but we're generating a bit more than we're using. And so we're getting money back from them. We can sell what are the SRECs. Of course, the market for them has gone down significantly, but in roughly 6 years or less, I'll have paid off the total cost.
Good for you. Well, thank you for your call, Dick. I appreciate it. And Ryan Mahandy in Houston, when it comes to access across the board, socioeconomically, are there areas in Texas where it's difficult to take advantage of good prices and competitive pricing? Are there economically depressed areas that don't have the same kinds of options? I mean, obviously, there are a lot of people who aren't going to have the $10,000 to invest the way our caller Dick was able to do, and he's obviously going to get a good deal, certainly in a few years if things stay the way they are. But in terms of access to people who are not who don't have particular economic means, what's the impact for them been?
Well, this is the big problem with solar panels to date, is that they aren't really cheap enough to be deployed on a mass level. And particularly in a state like Texas, where we don't have state-level incentives, people here can still qualify for the 30% federal tax credit. We don't have any sort of rebate programs that are offered as a state sort of policy. So you do have to be able to afford the cost of a solar panel system. And as a result, you, I think, haven't really seen much of that spreading across Texas. For example, there's a utility out in El Paso. It's actually still regulated. They have more than 270,000 customers, and only a couple thousand of those have solar panels. So it's really not hugely affordable for most people. They are becoming more affordable, the panels are, as time goes on. And really, I mean, that's the main benefit to, I guess, a retail electric provider that connects you with so-called green energy, is you can still, without having $10,000 to put down for a solar panel system, you can still, in a way, subsidize and participate in green energy.
And Kent Motes, let's talk about jobs in the green energy industry. I understand that wind and solar, those industries are among the fastest growing sectors of employment in the United States nationwide. In 2016, the Maryland legislature passed a bill called the Clean Energy Jobs Act. The governor opposed it. He thought it was too expensive. But what is your take on the impact for employment opportunities here in our state?
Well, I think the governor said so, and part of the reason why he opposed it was because of the increased costs on consumers, and that has an impact on jobs across the state. And so I think when we're looking at those types of things, it's important to really understand what the impacts are on not only jobs but also on each individual consumer.
And Tim Brennan, I'm going to give you the last word. We just have 30 seconds left. Is there any data that says that these independent markets are, in fact, having an impact on encouraging people to use alternative energy?
I think, as people have said, that for those people who are self-motivated, it gives them opportunities. But my own sense of the situation is that it's not enough. We still need good, strong environmental policies out there of various sorts. A lot of economists like carbon taxes for that reason, that one has to rely on things like that and not just the goodwill of those customers who decide on their own that they're going to decide to do their bit for the environment.
Tim Brennan is a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and he's also a senior fellow at Resources for the Future. Ryan Mahandy covers energy for the Houston Chronicle, and Kent Motes is an energy policy manager at the Maryland Energy Administration. I'm grateful to all three of you for our conversation today. Thanks so much.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow on Midday, another installment of Smart Nutrition with the nutrition diva Monica Reinagle. As well, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will be here. She's going to review Fallout, a play at the Vagabond Players here in Baltimore. Lunch was provided today by Dangerously Delicious Pies. We are grateful to them for that. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade, sweet, and savory pies and quiches. I'm Tom Hall. I appreciate your listening. I appreciate the work that Zandra Ellen put into our program today. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow.